Given the year we've had, we may as well end it on some trade news. And workplaces that challenge your mental health. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, December 31st. Thanks for joining us. This morning, President Trump tweeted he'll be signing a trade deal with China on January 15th, just about 2 weeks from tomorrow. That's just one of several trade headlines floating around at the moment, but headlines nowadays don't always mean action. Marketplace's Justin Ho is following trade news for us today. And Justin, what do we know about what's actually happening on the 15th?
Well, we know that the president used the words large and comprehensive to describe the deal, and we do know that the U.S. and China agreed on a tentative deal earlier this month. As part of that deal, we are told that the U.S. side will lower import taxes on $112 billion worth of Chinese goods, and China apparently agreed to buy a further $40 billion in American ag exports per year. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer has also said that China's made some commitments on issues like the forced transfer of technology for American companies entering China, but we just don't have any details.
And this is also just phase one of a potential larger deal that we're talking about.
Right, and it does not resolve all the trade issues between the U.S. and China. It doesn't touch the tariffs already in place on hundreds of billions of dollars worth of goods, and it doesn't touch the subsidies China grants its own companies. A lot of experts say that the subsidies are seen as giving China an unfair advantage in areas like tech and artificial intelligence. President Trump says he'll go to Beijing at some point later on to start talks on a phase two.
And because there can never be just one trade story at a time, let's not forget there's a U.S.-Japan trade deal coming into effect tomorrow. So, Justin, can you talk about that?
Right. So there, keep in mind, this is about agriculture, really. Japan says it's going to lower tariffs on U.S. beef, also wine exports, same with American pork and cheese. And the U.S. is cutting tariffs on a few Japanese products, like industrial tools and machine turbines. Worth noting that this deal does not involve cars, which is a big part of U.S.-Japan trade.
So to the other side of the world, let's move to U.S. trade with Europe. What's happening there?
The EU has a new trade commissioner who's set to come to Washington sometime in January. The big issue there is the steel and aluminum tariffs the US imposed on Europe in 2018. But let's not forget about tariffs on alcohol. The US put a 25% tax on European wine and spirits this year and is considering a 100% tax on French goods like champagne. So, you know, enjoy that toast tonight.
All right. It's been quite a year in trade. Lots of turmoil, ups and downs. Has it been worth it for the economy?
Well, there's, you know, a wide range of takes on that one, but the Fed came out with a study this month on the impact of tariffs on the manufacturing sector. And it said, yeah, you know, those have protected domestic industries, but those same industries saw big job losses and rising input costs and retaliatory tariffs. The Fed says those negative effects far outweigh any protection we get from tariffs. And also, we reported yesterday that the trade deficit did drop last month, but a lot of that drop came from imports falling, which could indicate that consumers are spending less. And if that weakness continues into 2020, it's safe to say we're going to be hearing a whole lot more about trade going forward.
Marketplace's Justin Ho, thanks.
You're welcome.
On Wall Street today, markets finished up a strong year with some big gains. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Because we can't seem to talk about politics anymore without talking about Twitter, Democratic presidential candidate Michael Bloomberg has set the internet ablaze with a tweet not about healthcare policy or impeachment, but office design. The billionaire latecomer to the campaign said yesterday if he's elected, he would turn the East Room of the White House into an open office where he could sit right smack dab in the middle of his staff. Cue the howls from workers fed up with the trend of wall-less workspaces. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
If the first decade of the millennium ushered in the idea of open offices, the last decade is when they went mainstream, with companies of all stripes tearing down cubicles and walls, putting workers in airy open spaces with those long communal tables for desks, like a big dinner party of creativity, or a nightmare, depending on your perspective.
People laughing very loudly, playing music on the phone, constant distraction.
Catherine Zimmerman, a programmer in Springfield, Virginia, echoes the complaints of a majority of workers who say they hate open offices, according to a survey from BossBar PR last year. A growing body of research demonstrates their negative effects, from a decrease in productivity and, surprisingly, communication, to an increase in flu cases. So will the next decade bring an end to open office madness?
I don't think any one extreme is the right solution. I think the combination is really important.
Karen Dillon is the author of the Harvard Business Review Guide to Office Politics. She says, frankly, the cost-saving benefits of open offices mean they're probably here to stay, but they could be evolving. Commercial interior designer Mindy O'Gara sees more workplaces adding private spaces, like small conference rooms, secluded corners, and phone booths.
It's designing space that fits the various iterations of work. Yes, you've got all these really beautiful open spaces, but you also have this ability to pull off and be alone.
If that's not an option, Karen Dillon says there are minor changes workplaces can make to better foster concentration.
Piping white noise into it so it mutes the sound, putting sound barriers where possible, not big full walls, but just, you know, things that will absorb the sound.
Kind of like the old-style cubicle. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Being in an open office can be particularly challenging if you have a mental health condition. Millions of Americans struggle with issues like depression or anxiety, yet many feel as though they can't get the support they need at work. In fact, for some, mental health can feel like a don't ask, don't tell topic at the office. That's the subject of a recent story by Cynthia Coons. She covers healthcare for Bloomberg. Cynthia, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So in one of your stories, you talk about a company that is investing in mental health care, but it doesn't seem to quite get it right. Why is this so challenging for businesses?
It starts at the beginning with how people feel about opening up about their mental health at work. The workplace is competitive in America, and people often live in fear that if they disclose a mental health condition, it will be used against them. And then there's the reality that there are laws to protect workers within the workplace, but you'd have to actually take legal action or go to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and file a complaint in order to use them against your employer. So people are loath to do that. And the secrecy and stigma around mental health keeps this problem festering behind the scenes where nobody really wants to talk about it.
Is there a way to judge how common it is that someone really does face some kind of backlash for disclosing a mental health issue in the workplace?
That's data I haven't really ever been able to work out, just because so much of this is held done privately. So even if a person were to take a claim to the EEOC, that would be handled through mediation. And so those precedents aren't necessarily public. And if employees sue their employer, that's something that will go public, but a lot of people settle, and then settlements end up in with usually non-disparagement clauses, and people don't talk about why they ended up in that position in the first place. Most of it's done quietly and behind closed doors.
Were there examples that you came across in your reporting of companies that were doing mental health support well and companies that were doing not so well?
I think the most encouraging thing that I found in my reporting is that so many companies and so many employers want to do a better job than they've done so far. So there were big companies like Cisco that were taking a new approach towards mental health. For example, they're giving emergency days off for things that aren't classically sick days or vacation days. Microsoft is building on-site counseling services. Companies like Chevron have actually stood out in the mental health arena, and they're actually now, in cases where it doesn't affect the safety or operations of the company, forgiving people for failed drug and alcohol tests and helping them get into recovery. So a lot of companies are stepping up and trying to make a more inclusive and open workplace where you can talk about your mental health and you can seek help and it wouldn't be used against you.
And what about the companies that maybe aren't doing so well?
I wouldn't necessarily want to point a finger at a specific company for not necessarily rising to the occasion. And in fact, consider the fact that it's much bigger than that, and it's much more of a question of how large companies address this from a leadership perspective and ensure that people much lower down the chain are getting the access and treatment that they need. And some of that really just comes down to whether or not the insurance that they offer, the health insurance, has adequate mental health coverage, because that's another consistent problem where people go to use their insurance and they can't access mental health care.
Yeah, you mentioned in one of your pieces that people who try to use their insurance to get mental health care will often find a long list of therapists or psychologists that aren't accepting new patients or that charge more than the insurance company will reimburse.
Yeah, these are called ghost networks, and they're basically networks full of psychiatrists and psychologists that don't actually take the insurance plan that they're listed under. It's so common. I was almost awash in stories of this. It was just unbelievable how many people told me examples where their insurance plans listed in network providers just were not available to them. And so a lot of what needs to happen here is employers need to really push on their insurers and figure out if their services are adequate. And I think in 2020 and beyond, there's going to be some larger scale initiatives where the employers actually start to push for this. But it's a really critical piece of the problem, because it's not just about coming out and saying, I have a mental health condition. It's really about being able to get the chronic lasting therapy to live with that and manage your symptoms on an ongoing basis.
Cynthia Kunz covers healthcare for Bloomberg. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Many people depend on a part-time job, including workers over the age of 55, the fastest-growing segment of the workforce, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And this week, we're hearing from some of these workers for our series, My Economy. This one comes from just outside where I am in Washington, D.C., where many part-time jobs were put to the test.
This is Chip Hunter. I live in Northern Virginia, Loudoun County, about an hour outside of Washington, D.C. Two and a half years ago, I retired from a government contracting position. I can't discuss the particulars, but I like to think that I was able to work with people who help us sleep safely at night. I was in an environment which is more youthfully oriented, and then I noticed some other folks of my age were beginning to, be excused from their responsibilities. And it was not any kind of unpleasant situation, but it became clear that my work had been done, and more of my responsibilities were being relieved. So it was just time. So I found that there was a kind of a raw instinct inside of me to go do something. I was invited to be a narrator at a historic park, which seemed kind of interesting until I discovered that it was 365 days a year, weather not being a consideration, and it was tough. I joined a fellow that I knew on a paper route. So hurling newspapers was not something I was good at. And so I had to thank them very kindly and step away from that. I am currently involved in the wine industry here. On the weekends, I work at a vineyard pouring wine for people who are interested in learning and tasting our product. And it is a part-time job, so I have lots of free time as well. And I think my part-time work has really helped me understand how difficult some of these jobs are that we maybe don't take full appreciation of until we try to do it ourselves.
Chip Hunter, pouring wine in Northern Virginia. Let us know what's happening in your economy at marketplace.org. coming up.
Today, we really have an affordability crisis in many places.
A look back at the long tail of the financial crisis. But first, let's do the numbers. On the last trading day of 2019, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 76 points, more than a quarter of a percent, to close at 28,538. The NASDAQ climbed 26 points, 0.3%, to finish at 8,972. And the S&P 500 delivered 9 points, more than a quarter of a percent, to end at 3,230. For the year, the Dow rose more than 22%, the NASDAQ added more than 35%, and the S&P advanced more than 28%. But when you look at the decade, the Dow was up more than 173%, the NASDAQ increased more than 295%, and the S&P boosted more than 189%. The Case-Shiller Home Price Index was up 3.3% in October. Without evidence of strong demand, home builder D.R. Horton hammered up 0.3%. Bonds fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.91%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
This is it, folks. Just a couple of days left in this decade, which means time is running out to support Marketplace and make it count for this year. Any donation makes you a Marketplace investor and a partner in our mission to make people smarter about this economy. And don't forget, if you give at least $60 or a monthly donation of $5 or more, you'll get exclusive access to our 2020 Ask Me Anything virtual event series. Find out more and donate at marketplace.org. And thanks.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. To some international news now. In South Africa, the government has started issuing permits to people who used to be illegal miners. The country is one of the world's leading diamond producers, and until recently, groups of illegal miners engaged in running battles with police and private security forces for invading mine properties. But now, the new permits have prompted a diamond rush in the mining town of Kimberley in the Northern Cape Province. The BBC's Nomsa Maseko reports.
In Kenilworth Cemetery in Kimberley, it's not graves they're digging right now. Hundreds of small-scale miners have set up camp here, and they're looking for diamonds. This area used to be a mine dump, and now men and women cover the ground, consumed by the same task. Using picks, shovels, plastic buckets and sieves, they work quietly, meticulously sifting through piles of soil in search of a diamond, a passport out of this hard life. Just a few months ago, this would have been illegal and extremely dangerous. There were frequent clashes with police and mine security.
We were also declared terrorists by our own government, so it was a hard journey. It was a hard route. But it's determination, knowing what we want. That's what drove us to where we've come.
Obakeng Munyera used to mine under the cover of darkness, but now he carries a mining permit.
It wasn't easy to get a permit. It was bloodshed, sleepless nights, being put on the hit list of the mines, going to jail. I almost lost my eye, as you can see. But that didn't break our spirit. We knew what we wanted, and now we have what we've wanted.
Diamond mining used to be the driving force of South Africa's economy. The first diamond was discovered back in the 1860s, the 21-carat Eureka diamond, and a diamond rush soon followed. And even when it was illegal for artisanal miners, it was an attractive form of income. Carrying a 20-liter bucket full of crushed rocks, 77-year-old Clara Maidze has been arrested several times over the past decade for illegally mining precious stones, but she's unrepentant.
I'm looking after my 9 grandchildren with the money I've made from selling diamonds. I've been able to build them a home and put them through school.
And now the mother of 11 praises the government for decriminalizing artisanal mining.
Our industry has been formalized. That means no South African should ever grow hungry. Youngsters must roll up their sleeves and work for their money, because the earth and its minerals belong to us.
The new permit system has restored the dignity of artisanal miners, and that means they no longer have to risk their lives to put food on the table. In Kimberley, South Africa, I'm the BBC's Nomsama Sego for Marketplace.
The subprime mortgage crisis happened in 2008, but the consequence of that crisis and the recession that came with it still shape our economy today. But suffice it to say, the housing market in the 2010s was defined by what happened in 2008. Marketplace's Amy Scott joins me to talk about the decade in housing and how the industry has changed since its low point just over 10 years ago. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Kimberly.
So take us back to 2010. It was a pretty bleak time in the housing market.
Yeah, it's almost hard to remember, but we were still clawing out of the housing crisis. Foreclosures peaked in September of that year. There were 120,000 homes foreclosed on in a single month, almost 3 million that year. And prices hadn't yet reached the bottom. That wouldn't come until 2012. And at that point, the median home price had fallen below $155,000, which was down more than 30% from the previous high. And the home ownership rate actually kept falling to a low of about 63% in 2016, which was the lowest rate in half a century.
Yeah, such a scary time. So what's the housing market look like today?
Well, it's like a complete 180 in a lot of ways. We've more than recovered. We've seen years now of steady price growth. National prices are up nearly 60% since the bottom. They've been rising much faster than incomes. And today we really have an affordability crisis in many places because there is a shortage of homes for sale, especially at the lower end of the market. That's partly because builders scaled way back after the crash. They've been slow to recover. They say high labor costs and material costs and a labor shortage are holding back building. A lot of workers left construction after the crash and didn't come back. And also builders say, you know, regulatory costs, things like zoning restrictions make it hard to keep up with demand. But we have seen an uptick in new home construction in the past few months, and home builders are predicting an increase in building next year, which could take some of the pressure off prices.
Let's look ahead to next year. What else should we be watching for?
Well, zoning is a big one. It's funny. It's become kind of a hot button issue. Cities and states have been moving away from single family only zoning to increase more density in cities. And that's also created a lot of pushback from homeowners who are worried about property values falling if their neighborhoods are more crowded or parking and traffic problems. But I think that's going to continue. We're going to see more communities taking a look at increasing the density in their neighborhoods. Also, rent control is a big one. New York, California, Oregon have all recently expanded rent control protections. More places could follow because, you know, though the home ownership rate has recovered somewhat, it's about 65% now, where it was 63% at the bottom of the crisis. More cities have become majority renter, and the same problems that are affecting home prices have also been pushing up rents to the point where nearly half of renters now spend more than a third of their incomes on rent, which would be the level considered affordable.
It's been a decade since the foreclosure crisis peaked. What are the chances of something like that happening again?
Well, it's on everybody's minds, I think. I was at a big summit of housing economists recently, and none of them are predicting anything like that, at least in the year ahead. But because of that demand-supply mismatch, because there's more demand than there is supply, that's going to keep prices high and probably growing. Meanwhile, you know, mortgage delinquencies are low. Interest rates are expected to remain pretty low, which also supports the housing market. And of course, a lot depends on the economy. If, you know, suddenly people are losing their jobs, that's going to affect the housing market. But right now, the outlook is pretty solid.
Marketplace's Amy Scott, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Speaking of looking ahead to the new year, do you have financial goals on the agenda for 2020? Marketplace's personal finance reporter, Samantha Fields, has tips on how to make New Year's financial resolutions that stick. Check out that and all of Samantha's coverage on our website, marketplace.org. It's part of our Check Your Balance collection. This final note on the way out today, the new year always comes with a bunch of new laws. In the Midwest, Illinois is legalizing recreational marijuana. On the East Coast, New Jersey employers can't demand job seekers divulge their previous salaries. And New York is eliminating cash bail for nonviolent felonies and misdemeanors. But not all the new laws will necessarily take effect tomorrow. As the New York Times points out, California's new law banning the sale of products made from alligator skin is on hold. That's because of a restraining order in a lawsuit from the country's leading producer of alligator skins, the state of Louisiana. We've got to go. Today, the Dow rose 76 points, more than a quarter of a percent. The NASDAQ climbed 26 points, 0.3%. And the S&P 500 delivered 9 points, more than a quarter percent. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sitara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. And I'm Kimberly Adams. Happy New Year's Eve. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.